Hello, and a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive library of over 6,000 films brings together cinema from across the globe. There are comedies ranging from Whiskey Galore to Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, chilling classics such as Don't Look Now and Under the Skin, and British cinema favourites including Submarine and The Wicker Man. We're doing our very best to explore it all in this podcast. This time around, we're doing something a little different. Rather than focusing on one film, I'm delighted to be joined by author and critic Stephen Bourne, and we're going to be exploring just some of the queer cinema in the Studio Canal catalogue. Stephen is the author of Brief Encounters, Lesbians and Gays in British Cinema 1930 to 1971, and also the book Black in the British Frame. Stephen, a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast.
Thank you.
Whenever we start a podcast and bring a guest in, we like to start just by getting a film fact off them first. So you brought one along with you.
I have. I go back a long way. I'm one of the fortunate generation to have seen The Sound of Music, starring Julie Andrews, when it was first released. So I was a little lad.
That's amazing.
I know. In 1966, I think it came around. 65, 66, it came around locally. To Peckham Odeon, which was my local cinema. So yeah. In the school holiday, my sister and I toddled off to the Peckham Odeon, because you could in those days as children, without adult accompaniment. And we sat through the film. They crammed all these screenings in, and we sat through it. It's about 3 hours,
It's not short.
It's not a short film. And we loved it so much, we were just spellbound, that we did what most kids did in those days. We hid under the seat while they turned the lights off to clear everyone out. And then we sat through it again. But by the time we got home, it was about 6 o'clock, and our mum was on the doorstep, like, "Where have you been? Where have you been? I'm going to call the police." And we didn't have the phone in those days, so she would have had to have gone to a phone box, and we just got a good old telling off.
So if you sit through The Sound of Music twice, you've had a great time, but you've generally missed two birthdays by the time it comes to an end.
Exactly. We're growing up on a housing estate in Peckham, which was wonderful. It's like a big playground.
Yeah.
But to be transported to the Austrian Alps.
Love that.
And all these nuns and all these children and all these wonderful songs, we were just spellbound. So we had to sit through it again.
Did you go back again afterwards?
I don't think we were allowed.
Were you banned?
I had to wait for it to come out on DVD or... No, it would have been video.
You had to wait for DVD to
or
be invented.
On television. Yeah, yes. Wait for DVD. Thank you, yeah.
I'm in the same boat. So, Stephen, your book, Brief Encounters, which I just mentioned before, was published back in 1996, and a real snapshot of early lesbian and gay images in British cinema. Can you just introduce us to the book a little bit and some of the films that you were exploring in it?
Yes, I mean, just to clarify why it's called Lesbians and Gays, it was pre-LGBT+. Again, I'm so old, I come before LGBT. But it was really just a simple survey of lesbian and gay characters, lesbian and gay actors and actresses in British cinema, popular British cinema, from a sort of film fan, film buff perspective. I was not an academic. I wasn't interested in theorising. The book got attacked by some lesbian and gay academics in academic journals. And so I fired off a Mr. South London angry letter to the Sight and Sound, which they published. But it was a wonderful opportunity for me to revisit lots of British films that I knew, discover British films that I hadn't, and find queer stuff that I hadn't seen before. It did get some good reviews, some positive reviews, and it did do well.
I wonder if the words you said there, popular, is the key one.
Yeah.
That's where your interest has lied, really, the popular side of cinema.
I would say so, I think, because that's what I grew up watching. I mean, apart from The Sound of Music, I was glued to film British films and American films on television. And I joined the National Film Theatre when I was still at school. I had to get like a special... I've still got the card, associate member. I had to be an associate member.
That's lovely.
I don't think I had to get a letter from my school or anything like that. But I did to do some research at the BFI, the British Film Institute Library. I had to get a special letter from school to say I was responsible and that I wouldn't be running off with pictures of Betty Davis or whatever.
And were you responsible and did you run off with pictures?
pictures of Bette Davis.
I did not tear any pictures of Bette Davis out of library books. No, that's a lie. I didn't do anything like that. I know there's been that rumour going around.
It was in Sight and Sound.
It was in Sight and Sound.
Just as a starting point then, Alfred Hitchcock's film Murder is one that you've talked about, and how Alfred Hitchcock isn't necessarily one who instantly you say to someone they'd think is a bastion of queer cinema. Tell me otherwise.
I would agree with you because, I mean, a lot has been written about queer characters in his film, Strangers on a Train, North by Northwest, which is my favourite Hitchcock film. So many. Even Norman Bates with his mother fixation. I mean, not a very helpful representation of a queer man, but no, Murder was one of the earliest Hitchcock films to have a sort of gay transvestite type character in it. And
yeah.
Of course, he's a murderer, he's a psychopath, he's a killer. You know, Rope is probably the most famous Hitchcock film with a gay couple who are killers. So it was that kind of representation. But in those days, people would have been gay men, you know, LGBT people would have been just hungry for any sort of representation that acknowledged their existence, even if they were unfortunate sort of psychopaths in Hitchcock films like Murder.
Going tonally quite the other way, you talked about the Carry On films as well, and I grew up adoring the Carry On films, and in particular, I think you saw, is it Carry On Constable is one that comes? So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Carry On Constable is the one where Kenneth Williams and Charles Hawtrey are playing police officers. There's a wonderful scene early on in the film where Charles Hawtrey turns up at the police station in his uniform with his budgie and a bunch of daffodils for the sergeant, played by a very crabby Sid James. I mean, it's so obvious.
Sorry I'm late, Sergeant, but I just couldn't leave home without bringing something bright and gay for the poor indisposed constables. It was off to my greenhouse, and with a little snip here, a little snip there, snip, snip, and here we are with my love. Oh, what have I said? With my very best floral greetings.
Thank you, I can't do something without.
But later on, they go undercover, Kenneth Williams and Charles Hawtrey, and are absolutely so at ease in drag as undercover officers in a department store, in the ladies' lingerie section, and looking out for women stealing. And it's just hilariously funny. And clearly, they are having a ball. They're really in their zone, so to speak. At a time when they couldn't come out as gay in real life, the law was still very much in place. It's a wonderful example of Kenneth Williams and Charles Hawtrey going over the top and loving every minute of it.
Do you know, I haven't done this since I was in the army, at a camp concert.
This is no laughing matter, Gorse.
I say, you mustn't call me that. Not when we're on special duty.
Oh, yes. Well, Agrafa, then.
Thank you. And I shall call you... Now, let me see.
Call me Ethel. It was my grandma's name. Oh,
if Grandmama could see you now, she'd be so proud.
It's oddly forgotten just how insanely popular the Carry On films were and just how regularly that they were coming along. I mean, in some cases, it was two a year.
They were almost every year. I remember my sister, who was older than me, going off to see Carry On Camping at Peckham Odeon. I wasn't allowed to go because of the Barbara Windsor bra scene.
I thought you were still banned after your Sound of Music
stuff. No. Of course, she was full of it when she came home. Barbara Windsor's bra came off. She was laughing her head off, and I was just sitting there with my arms folded, feeling very hurt that I hadn't been allowed to go because my parents probably considered I was too young. I was only about 10.
I think there was one of the Carry-Ons where they were on such a schedule that Sid James had had a heart attack at the start of the year. It might have been Carry-On Doctor. And so they wrote his character so he wouldn't have to get out of bed.
It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, they were so cheap. And they were paid pittance. But they're very much in the sort of queer cinema canon of British cinema, very important.
We've talked on this podcast before about the portmanteau horror Dead of Night as well.
Yes.
And we got particularly freaked out by the segment about a ventriloquist dummy. And I vowed I'd never talk about that segment ever again just because it's very chilling and scary and gave me nightmares. However, there's a subtext there as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I detected that early on when I saw the film way back in the 80s. I was recognising something about the Maxwell Freer ventriloquist character played by the brilliant Michael Redgrave.
Yeah.
There was some sort of undertone there, some sort of odd relationship between him and Hugo. Hugo Fitch, he even had a surname. And he's so spiteful and bitchy to Maxwell Freer, his ventriloquist. But he's a dummy, for goodness sake. But he possesses him.
Looks like I've been needing a new partner.
Oh, God. You don't mean that. You're joking.
Like hell I am. I've my career to think of.
You wouldn't run out on me now. I don't believe it. You wouldn't do that to me.
One of the very early talks I gave on sort of gay cinema, an elderly man came up to me and said, when I saw the film in 1945, I knew exactly what was going on. So thank you for bringing it out. But no one ever discussed it. You see, British film history books, we ought to say this, ignored all of this, ignored this interpretation or representation. It was all invisible. So no one had ever really got to grips with the way you could interpret these characters from a gay perspective.
Yeah.
When I wrote Brief Encounters, I was also conscious of the fact that British cinema was considered an old dark house full of cobwebs.
Yeah.
Nobody took British cinema seriously unless it was Powell and Pressburger or Hitchcock's early films. So when I was growing up, British cinema history had this terrible sort of reputation. But I loved it, and I got to understand that there was more to it than that. It isn't just about reclaiming the brilliant, dazzling Powell and Pressburger, who also had queer characters in their films. But the whole lot, you know, you could look at a lot of British films that you would never even think were queer in any shape or form and find something in there. That's what happened to me.
And another one that you've put on my watch list before we'd even met was a John Schlesinger film called Darling. You talk in the book about a brief but significant depiction of a gay man in that film. And this was Schlesinger, a couple of years before he went to do Midnight Cowboy?
Well, it was 4 years before Midnight Cowboy, but he's already signposting kind of gay characters in films. He himself, of course, was gay himself, but not out. I mean, it wasn't kind of known publicly that John Schlesinger was gay. But yes, the sort of character of the friend of Julie Christie's character, who she goes on holiday with, and very progressive for its time. Not a very big part, but Roland Curran, who played the role.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant, perfectly cast, lovely actor. He went on to play one half of a gay couple in a 70s TV drama. And so he went on to play other gay roles. But he's lovely in this film, and the relationship between him and Julie Christie's character is very liberating for that time, because this is still 2 years prior to the 67 Sexual Offences Act, which partially decriminalised homosexuality, so it's still before the act.
We are not complicating our holiday with any disgusting sexcapades.
Brother and sister, till death us do part?
Done. Share and share alike.
Everything's split down the middle.
Absolutely.
I was going to ask you about that. I just wonder how cinema turned after the 1967 Sexual Offences Act.
Oh, I think it helped enormously to liberate filmmakers. I mean, Schlesinger does go to Hollywood to do Midnight Cowboy, but he comes back to do Sunday Bloody Sunday in 1971, 4 years after the act. I mean, Peter Finch, absolutely superb as the doctor who has a relationship with a younger man who's having a relationship with an older woman, played by the wonderful Glenda Jackson. So you've got these relationships being depicted, and very groundbreaking in its day.
Well, Ducky, what do you think of our camp?
Oh, I think that's the word for it.
On the other end of the scale, there's Up the Chastity Belt, which I love because you've got Frankie Howard and you've got a gay Robin Hood played by Hugh Paddock.
Robin, I cannot thank you enough for your timely rescue.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Ducky. We haven't had such a giggle since we rolled the Sheriff of Nottingham in the cow pasture, have we, lads?
No. So you had these films coming out. I mean, I wouldn't say flooding the market. You had another film that year, 71. It's all 1971, Villain, with Richard Burton as a queer thug.
Incredible
film. Who enjoys beating up his boyfriend, Ian McShane.
I lost a bit of money. Had to do a bit of hustling.
Back to that, are you? A bit sordid.
No ties, Vic.
What did I do? Keep you on a lead? I used to give you 100 a week. Flash car, good clothes.
Yeah, I know.
You didn't have to push poppers at 4 o'clock in the morning to little Soho scrubbers, did you? Did you?
No.
You've got Melody, which was Alan Parker wrote the screenplay. David Putnam produced it. Boris Hussein, who is gay. directed it, but with a sort of interesting relationship between Jack Wilde and Mark Lester. You have to watch the film to understand what I'm saying and read the book, of course.
Don't worry. We'll have the last laugh at this lot. Hand him up there. We'll jack this school like it. Give old Dix over there the old V sign and shoot off and do whatever we want to do. You mark my words, it'll happen before you can say Jack Robinson.
There's another film you've talked about in the second half of the 1960s, The Family Way. Oh, I like that gasp. I don't know if you've seen the trailer for The Family Way. The trailer is brilliant. I mean, the film itself, obviously well worth seeking out too, but it describes it as one of the most delightful catastrophes you've ever seen.
Because the characters that Hal Bennett and Hayley Mills play,
yeah,
they can't, or he cannot, consummate the marriage after they get married.
Come on, Jeffrey!
The Bolting brothers have done it, taken those very young people and made their very young marriage into one of the most delightful catastrophes you've ever seen.
What did you mean by that?
From a queer perspective, it's a beautiful performance by John Mills as Hal Bennett's father.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of ambiguity in his character. To set it up, John Mills plays Ezra Fitton, a northern dad who works in a factory. And it's a beautiful film, beautifully written, beautifully directed. But Mills gives one of the classic performances. Forget Laurence Olivier. Watch John Mills in The Family Way. He plays the perfect character. He's married with a son. The son gets married. And the film is supposed to be about this inability of the husband to consummate his marriage. But what it is very subtly about is the John Mills character, Ezra, cannot come to terms with the loss of his friend Billy.
Yeah.
So when he married his wife, played by the astounding Marjorie Rhodes, Billy went off. Now, there's ambiguity in whether could Billy Stringfellow had been Marjorie Rhodes' lover and the father of Hal Bennett, biological father, or could there have been more to the relationship between Ezra and Billy than we think? And there's lots of evidence in the film, some really poetic sequences where John Mills reflects back on that relationship. Not a sexual relationship, but clearly, I mean, he took Billy on their honeymoon.
Yeah.
But it's a comedy. It's not, you know, and it's a really wonderful, underrated film.
We were scrubbed off together in the same washtub in his mum's backyard. Went to school together, worked together. It takes a lifetime for a man to make a proper friend. What was I to do? Desert him? Just because of a few words spoken over me at an altar?
A few words.
Well, and to him. Anyway, that's when I most needed him.
But you had your wife.
Her? All she did was to keep squeezing my mitt and looking moon-faced at me. I began to think I'd married a woman with a slate short.
Mm. Happen you had. I suppose that's why you went off every morning at 7, the pair of you.
It's a very gentle, subtle film. Mm. But The Family Way is also very groundbreaking because it portrays working class people with respect.
Yeah.
Doesn't caricature them. Because up until then, most working class characters in British cinema, sadly, were caricatured. You know, the forelock tugging. All right, governor, you know, all this. Or the battle axes and all that. This is really not like that. And it's such a breakthrough film. And I'm just, as you can tell, sad that it's not better known and not given the credit it deserves.
I want to get your thoughts as well on 1963's The Servant. Robert Maugham, who wrote the novella which The Servant film is based on, his backstory to it, I was reading, was was a lot more overt than we get in the film. I just wonder, can you introduce The Servant and the story behind it to us?
Robin Maugham was the nephew of W. Somerset Maugham, and Robin was living, I think, in London in 1947 when his manservant introduced him to his 14-year-old nephew, inverted commas, and Robin Maugham understood exactly what this manservant was trying to do. It could have been entrapment, which would lead to blackmail because of the law. So Robin Maugham said no thank you and didn't get involved. But he kept that in his mind. And later when he wrote the novel on which The Servant is based, the film version, Harold Pinter wrote the screenplay.
Yeah.
It kind of picks up on that relationship between a gentleman from the upper classes, a wealthy gentleman, played in the film by James Fox, and this manservant, played by Dirk Bogarde, who is absolutely brilliant in the film.
It's an incredible performance, isn't it?
It is an incredible performance.
Look at all this muck and slime. It makes you feel sick.
Well, do something about it. You're supposed to be the bloody servant.
You expect me to cope with all this muck and filth everywhere? All your leavings all over the place without a maid, do you? I need a maid to give me help and hand. I'm not used to working in such squalor. And what I've got in my hands, you. Can't expect to get any work done in this place at all. As soon as they get the Uber going, you're straight up it. You're in everybody's way. Oh, why don't you leave me alone?
What struck me about the film, comparing it to something like The Family Way,
yeah,
the audience is not expected to like these characters or relate to them in any shape or form, but it's still a brilliant study of class differences. So it's kind of released after the Profumo affair, where Christine Keeler and the government minister, John Profumo, is found out using prostitutes, and all this sort of hypocrisy that was going on in government, the Tory government of the time, which led to the downfall of the Tory government. So it's all mixed up with that, but it's a fascinating study of cruelty and exploitation. And who is the audience supposed to relate to and sympathise with? And I found it very difficult because I couldn't relate to James Fox's character.
Yeah.
He's a little git and pompous. And you can understand why Barrett, Dirk Bogarde's character, wants to bring about his downfall and exploit him. And he brings his sister, inverted commas, down from up north to work in the house as a maid. And that's the wonderful Sarah Miles. This was one of her early breakthrough films. She'd done Term of Trial the year before, and then she did The Servant.
Yeah.
Her character, Vera, and her so-called brother, but is he, or are they lovers? It's all very ambiguous and very multi-layered, but very, very complex.
Stand for any more of this.
Take your pigsty somewhere else.
It's not my pigsty, it's yours.
You creep.
Nobody talks to me like
that. Do you know what you are, Arthur?
I know
you.
All about your sort.
You're a peasant.
Peasant, I'm like. Get out of the way, I'll show you what I am. Tell you what I am. I'm a gentleman's gentleman, and you're no bloody gentleman.
It's an utterly engrossing film,
isn't it? And you can't watch it once. You have to watch it two or three times. And also, again, the subtlety of British filmmakers. You've got John Dankworth doing this fantastic music score. He's even in the film. I didn't realise until I watched
Harold
it.
Harold Pinter's in it as well, isn't he?
Harold Pinter. Yeah. It's very incestuous. But John Dankworth not only scored the film, his wife, Cleo Lane, gets her best opportunity in British films. She practically sings some of the script.
Yeah.
I mean, it's Harold Pinter's words. It is a song called All Gone, but it's very subtle the way the song's brought in on the soundtrack. And Cleo Lane was never really given her dues in films. I think she should have been Nancy in the film Oliver, but I'm the only person that's ever said it, so there you are, I've said it now. Must love without you alone. Leave it alone, it's all gone. But it's a very clever film, right from the director, Joseph Losey, to Harold Pinter, the screenplay, to Dirk Bogarde, and the performances in the film are just astounding. But it's not a film, it's not The Sound of Music.
No.
There's no happy endings.
Losey was a late replacement as well, wasn't he? Was it Michael Anderson?
Yes, that's true. And there are stories that Dirk Bogarde directed the film for 2 weeks, because Losey was taken ill, but if you read the biography of him, that huge War and Peace biography, which is absolutely wonderfully researched, Bogarde hated it, hated taking over the direction, and had harboured thoughts of becoming a director himself, but then decided, no, it didn't want to go back to that again. So there's lots of stories connected to the film, but an absolute landmark in British cinema. When I was at film school in the 1980s, we watched Battleship Potemkin and F.W. Murnau's Sunrise. Brilliant films, don't get me wrong, I love them. But why weren't we watching films like The Servant? Oh, because it's British.
Well, before we run out of time, let's just bring things back up to almost present day. I mean, I was looking through the catalogue and The Imitation Game called out to me, which is a film that took... I remember writing news stories about just how long this took to come to fruition. There was a version that Leonardo DiCaprio was going to appear in at some point. Can you just talk to us a little bit about The Imitation Game?
I saw it first when it came out, and I was disappointed. And I was disappointed because I felt... It seemed to me at the time part of that genre of cosy British film actors. They're all pals, they're all lovies. That was how I felt about it the first time I watched it. When I watched it again a few days ago, I actually changed my mind, because I actually think it's a very brilliant film in the way it portrays the hypocrisy of British society towards gay men, particularly Alan Turing. It really comes over very strong how he was appallingly treated in that terrible period after the war, when there was this witch hunt of homosexuals in the early 50s, and it really brings that out. And I think Benedict Cumberbatch gives a fantastic performance, and it's interesting when you compare him to Dirk Bogarde in The Servant, John Mills in The Family Way, three very different kind of gay, queer, possible characters, ambiguous.
You can't let them leave me alone. I don't want to be alone. I don't want to be alone.
But I think some of the criticisms from gay men at the time the film came out, and I understood that, was that you never actually saw him in a loving relationship. But I actually admired the film much more the second time around. So I do thank you for asking me to revisit it.
It also struck me with that film that films are a snapshot of the period of time in which they come out. And I think in the case of The Imitation Game, for that story to be as overt as it was and to cut through, I mean, it was a global box office hit, wasn't it? But Oscar nominations left, right and centre. I mean, it's depressing. It takes until 2014 to be able to tell a more honest version of that story. But the flip side of that in my head is it's refreshing that that story can go through relatively uncompromised and then find such a global audience, and that strike without having to hide really what it is.
And it was well cast, particularly Benedict Cumberbatch, and they didn't bring in a Leonardo DiCaprio, a Hollywood star actor.
Can you imagine?
Now, of course, the debate would be, is Benedict Cumberbatch gay? You know, we should have gay actors playing these parts. But he is superb. And it taught me an awful lot about Alan Turing, because I did go to the library to find a biography of Alan Turing, but it was bigger than War and Peace and I couldn't read it. So I just sort of skim read about Alan Turing at the time and realised what an astounding British historical figure he was. But also as a gay man, how wonderful it was that he was reclaimed. I think there's a statue to him and there's been a pardon from the Queen, the late Queen.
Yeah.
Not Elton John, Elizabeth. And we've gone through that process, and I think that is quite remarkable, because, again, going back to The Sound of Music at Peckham Odeon in 1965, I grew up gay, working class in South London. I never imagined a world in Britain, where I live, where things like that would happen in my lifetime. Yeah. So I'm thankful for that.
You know, this morning, I was on a train that went through a city that wouldn't exist if it wasn't for you. I bought a ticket from a man who would likely be dead if it wasn't for you. I read up on my work. A whole field of scientific inquiry that only exists because of you. Now, if you wish you could have been normal, I can promise you I do not.
So, basically, if I'm setting up a screening for us now, all I need to do is track down the Peckham Odeon, a proper 35mm print of The Sound of Music, and then arrange it so the seats are adjusted so that adult us can hide under the chairs between screenings and then sneak into the second one as well. Would that sound like bliss to you?
As long as we could have orange juice and ice cream.
Oh, it's a date. Stephen Bourne, this has been an absolute delight. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You'll find the majority of the films that we've just been talking about on the Studio Canal Presents channels on ITVX Premium, Apple TV and Prime Video. The Servant is also available on 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray. I'll be back soon with your regular episode of Studio Canal Presents. Just to bring to your attention before I go, that Evil Dead Rise, which we've covered before on the podcast, is now available to buy on DVD, Blu-ray and 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray, as well as to buy and rent on demand. Until the next time, to find out more about Studio Canal films and the ITVX, Apple TV and Prime Video channels, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on Twitter, Instagram and TikTok. I'm just off to hide under the seats at the Odeon in Peckham. Thanks for listening. Ta-ta for now.